Okay, hold on. Why are they so... Okay, he is on his way.
Sometimes if you don't log on early, Zoom has updated, and it takes a couple minutes to load the update.
Yeah.
So you think you're just going to jump on like you usually do, and you find that it takes you a little time. The less often you use Zoom, the more likely you are to have an update between the last time you used it and the next time. Susan, we can't see your camera. It looks like it's aimed at the back of your screen or something.
It is, because I just got out of bed. When I'm more composed, it'll come up.
Yeah, it's just lost a week because my computer just melted down.
Oh no.
And just getting it into service, and it was the holiday weekend. I ended up just buying a new computer last Sunday.
And oh my God.
But it's so fabulous. It's like the screen, I can really read things on it. Now I have a sound on my, I haven't had sound on my computer for a couple of years. It's just really having really good tools make the difference.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, hello. There I am.
Hi, Edgar.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, you should say.
Welcome. Okay. I don't think we have everyone here, but I also know that, Edgar, you... have about 90 minutes with us, and then you have to go.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we just introduce ourselves very quickly, and I'd like to spend most of the time for Edgar to share his talk on digital cash, and then have a chance to speak with him about specific questions that we may have about that. And I would include central bank digital currency as well, because he's quite knowledgeable about that topic. So how about everybody just say your name and what city you're in, and then we'll get started with Edgar's talk.
Virginia Hammond in Portland, Oregon.
Sue Hello. Peters, New York City.
Lucille Eckrich, Bloomington, Illinois.
Hello.
Howard Schweitzer, Linden, Tennessee.
Hi, Howard.
Hi, now I'll stop calling you Switzer. I always in my mind had you as Howard Switzer. So,
yeah, a lot of people do that. I answered both.
Dan Sullivan, Pittsburgh, well, McKeesport, Pennsylvania.
Hello, hello, Darko Dodik from beautiful sunny Croatia.
Hello.
So for you, it's in the midday, then, or in the afternoon.
Yes, it's about 5 p.m. right now.
Okay. Mark, you want to say Mark, you want to say your name and where you're from?
Sure, Mark Young, Indianapolis.
And I'm Bo Young Lam in Toronto, Canada. And I'd like to present Edgar Vortman, who is an IMMR core member, as well as a lead person, lead monetary reform person at Ons Geld in the Netherlands. And for work, he is a corporate lawyer specializing in financial law. So I'll pass it over to Edgar, and I will record the session. Edgar?
Yeah, well, okay. It's okay to take it over, but I do not have much of a talk. I would like to have a dialogue or a discussion, but I will try to give that a start by telling something about my background and how I look at the monetary system. My background is legal, so, and that's very different if you juxtapose this to economists, because legal people always want to have clear definitions. And economists can live with ambivalent phrases and terms and have statements made that can always be interpreted in any way you like, so that you're always right in what you say. Legal people don't like that, basically. They want to have a straightforward system with unambiguous definitions. So this is how I look at money. And when I look at economists treating money, I see that they put eggs and apples in one basket and call that money. And they put two very, very different things in that basket. The one thing is the physical objects, the physical monetary objects. You can call money like coins and notes. And something derived from those objects, which are not the object itself, but claims or promises of these objects. And if you look at that from a legal point of view, these two things are very, very different. It's, you can compare it, if you take an apple, for instance, an apple is an object, and now you can have an apple in your hand, which is your own apple, so you know you have it. It can also have a relationship with someone who tells you that he has apples or might have apples and is willing to give you an apple whenever you want it, or whenever you have enough apple credit with him. So then you see that in the first idea of having an apple in your hand, it's very straightforward, it's very real what you have. In the second situation, it's very depending on the credibility and the credit worthiness of this other person. So in the European law systems, for instance, the Dutch and German law systems, we make a very clear distinction between relative rights. These are rights, for instance, like a promise of an apple, so it's more like a contract, and absolute rights. That's more a right that you have in property, for instance, ownership. And well, economists just disrespect this. They think, well, money is money, and we put promises of money and money in the same box, in the same basket, and we say this is money. And this is where it goes wrong with the money system, because in fact it's very different if you have money or that you have a promise of money. So it's the difference between money and potential money. Well, I base my whole looking at the money system on this very basic difference. Now I drafted a paper or a blog, I should say, about digital cash. And in that I claim that because of digital technology, we can overcome a very basic problem with the money system. Maybe the problem that we've had for ages with the money system. And this problem started, for instance, in the time that we had silver coins and gold coins, because there was a difference between the intrinsic value of a
silver coin or a gold coin. That was the value of the silver content, the gold content, the metal content. So they call that metallism in historical doctrine about money. And another way to look at money was that it had its nominal value. It was not the value that was the value in the coin in the form of metal, but it was the value of the coin as it was written on it. So the value that was the coin was coined for, you could say. So there you have two concepts of looking at the value of money. The one is about the real value in the coin, metallism. The other one is the payment power that's embodied by that coin, nominalism. And now you see that history, the history of money, is about those two things interacting with each other and always giving problems. Now, at a certain time, not that far back in history, the idea that money is gold or money is silver, so metallism, has been abandoned. In the doctrine of looking historically at money, one could say nominalism won. So there is no two concepts of money anymore. But it's just nominalism. It's just what we say that is the payment power in money. That is the value of money. So it's based on what we write on it, what we had as a convention together. But that's seemingly true, but that is not what's happening in reality now. Because still we have in our bank money system two concepts opposing each other. One is nominalism, the idea of a fixed value of a certain sum of money, for instance, the sum of money you have on your bank account, which has a value. For instance, you have $100 on your bank account, so then you, in a nominalistic system, you would think, well, this is $100. So that is the nominal value of that. But because of this money is not like the apple you have in your hand, but it's the promise you have from your banker. And in this this difference, there is also the difference between the nominal value of your deposit and the real value that's backing that deposit. Now, if the money on your bank was your money, like an apple in your hand, you would not have a problem with it, because if your banker would go bankrupt, that would not affect your money. But in the world we live in, this hurts you, because if your banker goes bankrupt, you will see that the intrinsic value of the money rules, in fact, and you have nothing anymore in your hand, because the promise disappears with the promiser who disappeared. Now, we have built a system, a money system, on these promises. You also see that in the when you see pictures of the Bank of England. They're always very proud to show a logo in which you see, I promise to pay, because the whole banking system is based on promises to pay. And we built a money system on that for a reason, for two reasons, actually. In the time that we thought gold is money was scarce. So it was a good thing to invent something, to derive something on top of gold, to make the money system more flexible. So then it made sense to say, well, we have some gold somewhere, and we base a larger amount of money on that. That was one reason, and this reason is already obsolete, because we have created another way of making flexibility in our money system. That's because we created now out of thin air. So we don't need any gold anymore, we just need the promise. We need two parties engaged into a contract, and then they create money. So flexibility is maybe already too much around us regarding the money system. But there was another reason, which until let's say, 20 years ago, was a rather sound reason to say why it was good to have a money system based on promises of money instead of money. And that was to enable us to do payment over distance. Because when you have physical objects as money and you want to pay, you have to hand over such an object as the act of paying. And that can be very easy if you're all in the same town. For instance, I'm in Zutphen and I want to pay to my neighbor here in Zutphen. I can do it that way if I have the money. But if we have to pay, for instance, to Croatia and from the Netherlands or America or Canada, then it's more easy to have some technology, a payment mechanism in between that enables us to pay without transferring physical objects, real money, you could say. So it had a tremendous added value to have a system for payment over distance. And that implied that you had a system without a payment system that was not based on the transfer of monetary objects. It was not based on real money. It was based on something derived from it, the promises of money. So there, the bankers come and play, and they take a very important position because they enable an integrated economy. Now, they enable a global economy. So governments were very eager to give all kinds of privileges to banks just to keep this system running, because it was important. But now, since the time of the internet, we don't need this system anymore. We can make a money system much more simple, transparent, and stable by not basing it anymore on the promises of money, which need to be backed by all kinds of financial assets, but just base it on monetary objects, but then not physical monetary objects, but digital monetary objects, digital things that we can hand over to each other as a means of payment. And this is where the digital cash come in, and this is where it's not really correct to associate monetary reform always with the Chicago plan from the 1930s, because in the 1930s it was not yet feasible to think about money and handing over digital objects the way we can think about it now. I think that's since 1994 that we can envision something like this. And you also see then in the work of Mr. Minsky that he is signaling that in 1995, and says, well, the time that we have a system, an institutional setup that ensures that a claim on a bank trades at par, exchanges at par with the currency, this must be reviewed because we don't need this anymore, and it's very complicated and risky. So that's a famous economist that when the internet comes into play, he sees that it's just a matter of logic, economic thinking, and that is therefore economists that do see the difference between apples and promises of apples, that it's no longer needed to have a money system based on promises. We can base a money system on digital money. So there, this is then my introduction on digital cash. So maybe I leave it here now for my independent, my solo talk. And maybe it's good for you now to respond on this.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. We will open up the floor to questions or comments on anything that Edgar has said or anything that you would like to ask him that's related to this. The stack is open.
Lucille Stack.
Hello.
Anyone else?
Yeah. Dan.
Okay.
Sue Stack.
All right, Lucille, you want to start?
Really, it's a quick clarification question, and just to get things going. And actually, in the second paragraph of your paper, just where you bring the intrinsic value and nominal value to contemporary, to our day, and you say that today it still exists because money in the bank consists of claims to money. These claims have a nominal amount, which you explained in your talk now is really the numbers in the account, and then end quote, a fair value that depends on the probability that a bank meets its obligations. So my question is, just to be clear, when that term, when you say fair value, as sort of referring to the intrinsic value of the money, is what you mean there its purchasing power?
With the nominal value, I mean then the purchasing power. Relation to purchasing power is not that important. I think the most important thing here, because when you have a claim which has a certain value, and you can exchange that, you can hand it over, that has a certain purchasing power. But the question is, what is its purchasing power? And for claims on the banks, we have an institutional setup that ensures to a certain extent, because when it doesn't work anymore, we call it the crisis, the banking crisis or financial crisis. But we have an institutional setup that to a certain extent ensures that your claim on the bank has a purchasing power according to its nominal value. So that what this means in reality is that banks can get very cheap funding, because we lend money to a bank. We fund banking businesses without even knowing that we are doing that. We take risk in this. And still, we pretend that the claims that we have on that bank have the same value as its principal amount. And the government and the institutional setup is designed to uphold this belief. And now, I'm trying to make everybody aware that what should rule here is that when we fund a bank and we have a title as a result of that, currently we call those titles bonds or deposits. These are two very separate things then. That if we call it a bond, such a title, then it has a market value. So then it has a purchasing power, if you can sell it, so make it liquid and use it as a means of payment, or get money for it to use it as a means of payment, then it has a certain purchasing power, but this is not determined on the principal amount, not on the nominal value. It's determined by the market value, or the fair value, or the real value, or the intrinsic value. So the claim you have on the bank should not exchange at par with the currency, should not be in the nominal money system. It should be on the stock markets. It should be an investment. But currently we have something we call a deposit that is in fact a very special kind of bond or share, you might say. It has qualities of a bond, it has qualities of a share. And the government and the institutional setup supports that we don't look at the risk, that we don't value it at its real value, that we regard it as money and exchange it at par with the currency. And this is the core problem of the current system, and this is also where the solution lies, both in making the credit system more stable and more decentralized, and making the money system more stable and more supporting societal goals instead of supporting a bank money system or a banking cartel. Does this give some answer to your question?
Yeah. Sort of, yeah. You went far beyond the question, I think, but it just that. So I'll let it pass on and get some more. I think it just, it seemed to me maybe the word fair then is could be replaced with market or simply could be eliminated, because your point there is that, yes, there's the nominal value, the numbers in the account, and the value that depends on, you know, the bank meeting its obligations, and that's the flawed system. We're trying to get one, a system where the money is in sync, the nominal and the real value is one within the monetary system. But yeah, let me stop and let it go on. It's just maybe that word fair there.
Yeah, yeah. But I was thinking about what is the right word to choose myself. So I came up there with fair value, but the discussion is not yet closed. But only saying value may be also confusing, because nominal value is also value. So if you are able to always say principal amount and nominal amount, then maybe you can make the distinction. But at this point, people look at money as something that has value according to the principal amount. So I don't think it would be wise to use just the word value.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move to Dan.
Yeah, I was thinking that digital currency, that the big innovation in digital currency seems to be the more a somewhat anonymity of transfer. It still has to be issued, and Bitcoin is a ritual labor currency. In other words, it's computers rather than people that perform the ritual labor of solving increasingly complex mathematical problems, and that causes more bitcoins to be issued up to a limit where they won't allow anymore. I'm more concerned with, you know, if we had a digital coinage system, if it were issued by a government, then the stability of the government would determine the stability of the coin's value. And there, I do see an opportunity to bypass the banking system, although the government can. I see it easier to bypass the banking system with digital currency, in that the government can issue digital value to every citizen and then let them transfer it to do a lot of things in a more streamlined process. I don't see any problem. I don't see anything that makes the Chicago plan obsolete, because the Chicago plan was not really concerned with how money transfers, but with who issues it. So those are my thoughts on it.
Yes. I think an element that we have to put in the story here is something that we call debt-free money as compared to debt money. And then here, what is debt money? That is those claims to money. So those money promises, those promises of apples instead of apples. Debt money, it arises out of a contract, out of a legal act in which more parties are involved. So more parties together formulate their joint will, and out of that can arise money. That's that money that is money that needs some kind of backing. So if you have a debt money system in which the government is the central issuer, then indeed the credibility of the government is at stake here. But the way I look at digital cash, I don't see it anymore as debt money. It's not a claim anymore, but it has become a digital monetary object. It's money in itself. And that is like, for instance, a silver coin has been, or a not a nickel coin as well. They never had, in the way they work, they are not used because of their silver content, but because of their liquidity function. The fact that you can purchase something with it, you can pay your debt with it, according to its principal amount, to its nominal amount. Paper money has had a similar development. I'm not talking for the Netherlands. In 1994, the government abandoned the exchangeability of paper money at the Dutch Central Bank for bullion and silver. And at that moment, the paper money was not a claim anymore on the central bank, but it had become a monetary object. That was only realized that this had happened in the 1990s. So at the same time for that the internet came up, and it had to be realized that this change was establishing itself. And you see then that in the 1970s, 1980s, the status of paper money was still debated. And in the 1990s, the consensus emerged that paper money had become a chattel. It was just a monetary object. It was not a promissory note anymore. It was there. It worked as money because you can pay with it. You can pay your debt to a specified amount with it. And that makes it a monetary object, debt-free money, a non-recourse instrument. And the important thing of this is that there's nobody, no institution, no government, no central bank, nobody who has to hoard gold or silver, nor financial assets, to back that money. The only thing that you need is a good operation, a transparent operation of that money system. So then you get monetary, I call it not monetary policy, but monetary management, which becomes outward looking, not looking at the assets that you have hoarded on your bank balance sheet, but which start looking at the necessities, the societal necessities, the societal need for money. So it becomes outward looking because you get rid of this nonsensical idea that the money system is a function of what is hoarded on balance sheets of financial institutions, or in your case, on the balance sheet of a government. That's all, in my words, old school thinking. That's debt money system thinking. And this is the thing that we have to do away with, that it will be the great transition when new generations start seeing this. And then we can end the debt money system, and we can end all those mountains of debts that are now burdening our societies. So that was my answer.
Dan, did you want to comment, or can we move to the next one?
Well, I just think that I think the Chicago plan was a move away from debt money system already. So I'm more interested in how the digital digital coin would facilitate that. It seemed to me that if government issued the money just as the Netherlands did, if we issued paper money with no promise of exchange, and we didn't have this ritual where we pretended to borrow it from the Federal Reserve, that it would be debt-free money anyhow. But I see potential for digital to solve other problems. You know, when you transfer cash hand to hand, nobody sees what you've done. And I don't know, I've been told that digital currency is not quite as anonymous as people think it is, but that it is still more anonymous than transfer via a mechanism, whether it's a government bank or a commercial bank. So that, to me, was the difference of digital currency, is that it allowed for private, undetected transfer.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, then anonymity is an important issue. But I think when you go over to the digital world, you are in fact talking about transparency. And then the answer to that should be handling transparency and create a consensus about it. The mix of anonymity and digitization is a very difficult one. To me, it's even kind of a joke. When the internet started, everybody was talking about the cyberspace and also thinking about some bottom-up revolution that was uncontrollable. What you see is what dominates the whole thing, that is control, and that is panoptic influence. So when you go to a digital society, you have a problem in a way, because there is a lot of transparency, and you have to control that in a way that which fits to a democratic order. And that regards digital identity, regards money, regards all big data that's around there. And that is an issue, but it's not specific an issue for your money system. Then another angle on this is that already we have rules in place that when you are talking about not the real small money, everything has to be visible already, unless you're talking about huge big money, then there's no control anymore because it controls itself. But you can buy your bread or your cola anonymous, and I think it's easy to design in a digital cash system a way that you still can buy your bread and your cola anonymous. But I also think that's completely unimportant to do that, because why is it now allowed to be anonymous? Because nobody cares where you buy your cola or your bread. So, but it is an issue, but it's not specific for money.
Okay, can we move on to Sue?
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, Edgar. Hi, I'm Sue.
Hello.
Hi. I guess I'm confused about your definition. I guess the three things I always think about any money is who issues it, who controls the size of its money supply in total, and who gets the benefit of the initial creation. So can your digital cash, from those three points of view, could you explain?
Well, of course, we are campaigning for a public digital cash system to the public good. So in our logo, it says we want to have money creation for the public good. So that's the reason why we're here. That's the reason why we're campaigning. But that's not maybe my first point in this digital cash blog, but that's the underlying motivation, so that you have we want to realize a debt-free money system in which the government is the issuer of the embodiment of the general unit of value and does that purely in a transparent way to the public good. So it also should serve democracy and a democratic society. So it has also implications in how to look at democracy, because when you bring the money power to the democratic state, then you give a huge power to this democratic state. Mm-hmm. And it's also a power to make society more democratic, but it's also a power to control it. So it should also have, you should also include a vision about what is the course for democracy to develop when it, as we call it, matures by putting the money power under its control. And the way I look at this maturing is that when the democratic state takes control of the money system, it must see that in a representative democracy, this representative democratic institution must only do things that cannot be done via direct democracy. So if you take democracy seriously, you should put direct democracy first and the representative democratic state as a second best solution that only does those things that cannot be done by direct democracy. And then here you see a difference in view between our movement and libertarians. Libertarians try to put this one of those few things that should be done centrally by a representative democratic order. They say, no, put that just on the market. Let the markets do that. And then our position is, no, this cannot be done by the markets. This is one of the few things that representative democracy has to do. But representative democracy has to be aware that it's second best, so it has to be there to facilitate direct democracy. So then you get an idea of a state that only does the things that cannot be done purely bottom-up, but only do those things via representative democracy, which should be done collectively. And money is one of these things, maybe the most important of those things. So this is how I look at that. Does this satisfy your question?
Well, that's for it. It helps me understand about the issuance of it. What about the control of the size of the money supply? And who?
Well, we start with the current situation. So we have a certain money supply, and when you transition to the debt-free money system, the first thing you do is give the people the opportunity to convert their debt money, so their claims on banks, their deposits, to digital monetary objects. So what you do, in fact, is one final organized bank run in which deposits can go two ways. Either they become bonds, so they have their full risk implied, they are out of the nominal money system, or they are converted during a limited time period into digital cash. And that can be converted then one-on-one. That's the last period in which there is parity between claims on banks and money. And so then the public decides what part of its holdings, its claims on banks, on financial institutions, it wants to hold as money, so keep it in a nominal money system, or what part it wants to see just as an investment, but it bears its full risks. At a risk then, after this transition period. So then you have a starting point in which people withdraw deposits from bank and convert that into cash, either physical or digital. So there you start with your starting money supply, and that's just the current money supply with one thing added, that the people has now been made aware that you have to make a distinction between money that you lend out, invest in a business, and money that you have in your digital safe. And then from then on, there is one golden rule for governance of the money quantity and also of the money supply, so the allocation of money, and that's that it should maintain its purchasing power at all times. So there is no inflation target, but there is a zero inflation target. Because if you have an inflation target, you also have to compensate that with interest. And the idea of our debt-free money system is that it is an interest-free money system. So money that's in your digital safe should not extract value from somewhere on the planet. It should be just there in your digital safe, and you save it, so this means you do nothing with it. But it should also, that should also not yield a return then, but it should also not cost you money.
Ooh. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hobart?
Goedemorgen, meneer Boortmans. Finally we meet.
Well, you don't have your camera on, so I don't see you.
No, indeed. You only have a name. That's it. I am under-technologized. Sorry about that. I just got into the conversation when I heard that you are living in Zutphen. That's interesting because I live there too, and it's a cute little town. Just to tell
how
my
is it possible,
friends.
And we don't know each other.
Well, I lived there between 1988 and 1990, just before I emigrated to the United States. So it's quite a while ago.
So I can't meet you here on the market.
No. By the way, Zutphen, I think in the Netherlands has the record of having a market that uninterruptedly functioned, I think, for 700 years.
Maybe
that it even functions during the German invasion. But that's that, you know, that's a little thing on the side.
Yeah.
Well, but I have good memories of that town. It was really, really nice. All right, get here to business about the digital cash. There are several items that I'm interested in. One of the things is so-called the technological infrastructure requirements to make this happen. When I came here to the United States, there were a few things that I never had to do. I didn't have checks. Here in the United States is a very busy way of exchanging money through checks. I never had a credit card, never needed that, so that's a big thing here. And the other thing was I never needed a car in the Netherlands because I could, bike or take the train, or hitchhike or whatever. And here in the United States, you really need a car if you want to move around. So what's happening here in the United States? So I just looked to some numbers about the so-called underbanked and unbanked people. Apparently 18% of the Americans are underbanked and 8% is unbanked, meaning that they don't have an account. So I don't know how they transfer money, but probably they're being paid if they have work with a check, and then they go to a place that will make their checks into cash. But those are not banks. Those are very sometimes shady for-profit organizations. Actually, the numbers are such that in some counties here in the United States, there's 40% of people are under or unbanked. So my question is then, what about that technological infrastructure? How to get your digital cash moved from one account to the other? Are you thinking of providing everybody with, let's say, an iPhone by which that can be done, or everybody will have a little device in his pocket, you know, by which we can exchange digital cash. I'm interested in that technological infrastructure. How you see that happening?
Well, in the first place, digital cash cannot coexist with bank money. So when we turn to the digital cash, the debt-free state-issued digital cash we envision, there can be no deposits anymore, only for a limited transition period. But digital cash can coexist with physical cash. So the physical notes and coins don't need to be abandoned. So whoever is not able to handle mobile devices or digital devices or able to buy them, he can just go on paying the way he did pay. But maybe we can add to it that we see then money as a public utility, and we see those digital safes as a public utility. They may be provided by commercial payment service providers, but the backbone, so the central administration of the digital monetary objects, that's a central thing, that's a government thing, that's the core of this new monetary authority. And well, that's a public utility, something that has to be run fully transparent, without any interest, any self-interest in the money it administrates, and without the need of acquiring, of hoarding assets to back that money. It's just the central system. It's just a computer system that has to be run neatly, and this can coexist with the current physical cash system.
Okay. So my understanding is that your proposal actually builds upon something that's totally similar to the Chicago plan, but just has this added feature that you know, of the digital cash. Because I do understand that, you know, in this system, of course, there will be something of a government entity that's in charge of the money stock, mm-hmm. to keep it non-inflationary. So sometimes they will have to create additional digital cash, or maybe even withdraw digital cash. So I think it's still something that is, built upon the kind of monetary reform. Personally, I just keep calling it sovereign monetary reform, because the money supply becomes a sovereign money supply. So how about then still the existence of checks and credit cards? And this might go a little bit outside of the digital cash question. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's about, I think that question concerns, should the government have a monopoly on money or not? Well, our position here is that the government should have a monopoly on the embodiment of the general unit of value. But it should not have a monopoly on money. There is another rule. So other private parties can create things that function as money. So we don't have to forbid banks issuing bonds or equity, or any company issuing bonds or equity which are used as a means of payment. But we have to ban one thing, make sure one thing, that the government never makes the mistake again to say, well, I will back those debt titles so that they can exchange at par with the currency. The government has to make sure one thing, that those debt titles exchange according to what I call their fair value, and not at par with the currency. So the government basically should confine itself to two things. That's have a monopoly on the embodiment of the general unit of value, and never ever again support private forms of money. And under these conditions, it can be allowed to the markets to be inventive and create all kind of niches and things which might substitute money as a means of payment, as long as it doesn't dominate the general money system. And having this in place is also gives more security, because the government might screw up with its governance of the money system. We can have this rule, well, you have to be transparent, you have to be honest, you have to be no self-interest, and you should aim at zero inflation. But maybe you end up in a state of Zimbabwe, or a state of Donald Trump, and the rules of the game are not taken seriously anymore. And maybe then the whole system goes down. And it's good that there is still all kinds of private infrastructures as a backup. So that also keeps the central system, the democratic system, the system of we the people, sharp. So this is how I look at that issue of other kinds of money.
So banks are still making loans by which they're not, so in the, or my understanding of the, you know, let's say the Chicago plan or the NEED Act, is that banks become intermediaries. They can only make loans based on, you know, the sovereign money they already have. They cannot just, you know, credit someone's deposit account with a loan made out of nothing. So here I hear something that you say banks could still do that, but it will not be called money anymore. But it's like a bond that will have that can go to zero value if they made a bad bet.
Yeah, but how want you do? You want to have a prohibition on extending credit?
They can extend credit, but they can only be intermediaries.
Yes, but in a way that's the same. If you say, I don't want to have any institution or anyone able to say, I give you credit, and I write it down here in my administration, so you get 10 now of my credit, that's just a contract that everybody is able to do. The point, however, is how meaningful is that contract? And that contract becomes meaningful if the government backs that credit. So if you want to counter this credit extension, which then at the same time is money creation, then you cannot prohibit credit extension unless you prohibit free contracting. But what you can do is make this credit extension meaningless in a monetary way, because you do not back it with government power. You just say to the markets, to everybody, and you do that persistently, you say, you're on your own. This is the Wild West. Maybe you win, maybe you lose. We're not there. You cannot call us. This is not what we call money. This is just gambling or contracting or having fun, whatever. This is the private sector. This is where you do your thing, but this is not government backed. That's the basic difference between that's the basic thing that you can do to prohibit make sure that there is no money creation by credit extension.
Yeah, it sounds to me then that it's a variation of free banking then, if I got it right.
No.
Everybody can set up a bank then and then create credits, but you know, it's not backed up by any government.
Yeah. Well, I think there should be another rule. So the idea, yes, everybody can extend credit, but now the question is, how can everybody fund its business? Because when you look at, in a legal way, where is the privilege of banks? It's not in credit extension, but in the way they fund their business. And what can a bank do what other businesses cannot do? It can attract money from the public without saying what it will do with the money, without a plan. Just say, I'm a bank and it's safe, give it to me. And then the government will support that. Well, if another business wants to attract money to fund a business, it has to issue a prospectus. It has to say, well, I have a plan, I have a business plan, so you can join in this business plan, and maybe you win, maybe you lose. So that's the normal way of funding a business.
Okay. I know we've got a bunch of people on the stack, and Edgar is only with us for another half hour until noon, so we'll do what we can to get to everyone, but I'm not sure that we will. I'd like to ask a question at this point before continuing with the stack. Edgar, can you comment on central bank digital currency and its role in monetary reform? It's a big thing in Europe, and there are pros and cons to that. If you could just comment on central bank digital currency.
Yeah, well, central bank digital currency is still debt money. But now we are centralizing that money, so we're hoarding the financial assets on the central bank balance sheet and make our money system dependent on the value of claims on our central bank, which will be a dangerous thing to do, because when we concentrate risk on the central bank balance sheet, we're sure we are ending up with a central bad bank, which then is the backing of our money, the debt money system. But I see also good things in a central bank digital currency, because it might be a way to end the debt money system in a controlled way, because you can use it by first centralizing money in the central bank, and that means centralizing debt in the central bank. And at a certain point, using this to deleverage the debt in the financial system, and to cut off the money from the money system from the debt system. It's a little bit technical, difficult to say without the drawings, but. If you see how now, for instance, Michael Kumhoff is looking at central bank digital currency, he says, well, there's one big design principle which is very important to us. That is, we can introduce central bank digital currency if we make sure that the parity between the currency and bank deposits remains in place. And now my statement is that yes, that's good for the transition period. That's good for the time that we are introducing our digital money system. And we do that within the paradigm of the debt money system. But then at a certain point, we must know that we are doing that for a purpose. And the purpose is to get rid of the debt money system. And that means that that's the same as ending parity between the currency and bank deposits. So CBDC can be used as a way to phase in digital money, and you do that while you maintain parity between the currency and deposits. And then when you have to phase in this new system, and you have overcome all diseases and technological problems with it, and people have got used to it, then you can say, well, now we unwind money and credit, disentangle money and credit by abandoning parity between bank deposits and the currency, which means that at that moment a bank deposit has become a bond. It's not government backed anymore, not valued at its nominal, but its principal amount, but it's valued to its real value, fair value.
Just a follow-up question, which is, I remember reading in some of your work that in a sovereign money system, a central bank would be obsolete.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit?
The function of a central bank is upholding the nominal value of bank deposits. So what does a central bank do? That's extending credit to commercial banks just to help us believe that the commercial banks are able to meet up their promises. Mm. So that all those money promises that we have there, that we don't lose trust in them. So if we might lose trust in deposits, in the promises of money, in those apples that we that are promised to us, then the central banks come there and does something, and that's also always giving something for nothing to commercial banks, just to uphold their balance sheets. So that's the function of a central bank.
Okay, great. Going back to the stat, Paul.
And when you want to finish this. And
hey, Edgar. Can you hear me? My connection is pretty bad. Hello?
Yeah?
Yeah, my connection is a little bad. So I have a more general question about digital currency. If, for me, as a monetary reformer, it almost seems like a sideshow. It's something I think that we need to be aware of, but monetary reform exists with or without digital currency. In some ways, there's some confusion between electronic money and digital money, and I see them as just technological variations of pretty much the same thing. I mean, we've been writing checks forever. We've been using our credit cards for decades. To me, that's equivalent to digital money. The only thing that I see as the issue is anonymity. You know, that Bitcoin can be used for illicit purposes. And that's something that I think needs to be, you know, that's something that cash can be used for as wealth. I mean, to me, that may be a factor. But it seems, again, to be somewhat of a sideshow with respect to monetary reform itself. It's more just technology. So I'm just a little bit, I'm interested in it, but it kind of seems like we have more important things to think about than digital currency. Do you think it's really an inherent necessary aspect of monetary reform?
I think it's the driving force. It's the reason why we have a chance to win this. And it's also the reason why we see that there is a lot of speed in actual the shift of thinking about money in the past 10 years. That's huge. And this is driven by the crisis and the idea that there will be a next crisis and that we might that it's about time that we come up with structural solutions to that instead of only fighting the symptoms. But the main driver, the really underlying thing, is the digitization. And it's also for democratic purpose important to stress that, because it illustrates that we have an opportunity to define the money system, the requirements for the money system, as we would like to see it. And when we have a digital system, it's logic that we say, well, a digital system is something that we create, it's something that we design. So when we do that, we first have to ask ourselves, what do we want to design, for what purpose? So this gives a reason for democracies to start thinking about the money system. But what should it look like if we ask ourselves the question, well, we need to design a money system. So how do we want to have it function? How should it be run? So it's very helpful. It's the driving force, and it's very helpful. So that's why we like to embark on this way looking at it. And it's also
by logic, the reason why we have a chance to win this, because there were two reasons why we had a bank money system. The first is create flexibility in the money supply. The second was to have something with which we can do payment over distance. And now, thanks to digitization, both reasons are obsolete. So there's no reason whatsoever now to have a bank money system. The only reason that we have it is that we have it. And that we do not see yet how crazy it is to have it. And digitization is the thing that made an end to the second reason why we still have this bank money system. So this is payment over distance.
Mm. That's not digitization. We did that electronically. We wired money for years. I think it's just...
That was bank money. So you did not wire money. You did wire claims to money. So you wired information about claims on financial institutions. And that is the difference. Going to a debt-free money system, that you do not wire information about claims on financial institutions. You wire information about the money that the payer transfers to the payee without any other financial institution in between. So there's no balance sheets anymore of financial institutions in between. But it means no commercial bank and no central bank. And it's very fundamental.
Okay,
great. We'll have Howard, Stephen, and hopefully get to Joe before we finish. So Howard?
Well, yeah, I'm still trying to get my head around this digital currency thing. And of course, like Paul says, it's a technology thing. We've been using electronic for a while, but it's the nature of the cash. I'm thinking that, and I can understand eliminating banks, but there still needs to be somehow to keep track. We say it's transparent. What are we seeing? Can a big corporation, for instance, say, I'm going to build a factory and I need $500 million? Where do I, how do I get $500 million to build my factory? And is that then just a private contract that you do with some bank or something that can still create money, but it's actual money and not promises? I'm not sure I understand how that would be. Yeah. Or say I'm a small business owner, well, I want to start a small business. I don't have the money.
The way we address this focuses on the word decentralization of credit. What you currently have is strong centralization of the credit business. And why is that? Because financial institutions, so those who can issue deposits or can issue things that are fit to be a monetary aggregate, so have some kind of government backing, those institutions have an advantage in attracting funding themselves. So they can issue what we think is money very easily. So this is a system in which money and credit are entangled. The way we look at money is a disentanglement of money and credit, and the monetary authority, the central authority, has to make sure that there is always enough liquidity, so you could say digital cash, well spread throughout society at all times. And why is that? For a few reasons. Most importantly, to be able to have buffers against financial crisis, so that financial crisis cannot become monetary crisis anymore. So for that, there has to be always enough liquidity buffers, which are not based on any underlying value, just money, digital cash. And there should also be enough for the public to invest. So in the digital cash system, basically digital cash is made inactive. It's in your digital safe. It's not lent out. You have it just waiting there to use it when the time comes there. And maybe one of those uses is lending it out. So you get a world where you get much more people able to invest, and a world where there's much more also digital infrastructure to help you invest. So the idea of a bank that's a place where you put your money and he secretly uses your money for its own account will disappear. And what you get instead is that you have platforms or intermediaries that make an investment opportunity available to you and also allocate risk. So if you invest, you carry also the risk. And there's then also a very clear distinction between holding money, which is interest-free and inactive, and investing money, which might yield a return, but comes with a risk. And it's always summarized in that currently we have a centralized credit system because certain financial institutions have government backing in attracting their funding. We want to go to a decentralized credit system where credit decisions are made by individuals. So, and are made by those who will carry the risk and who are knowingly going to carry the risk. So in a way that it's implying markets, market processes, market discipline in credit. That's part of the disentanglement of money and credit. And now this monetary authority has to make sure that there's enough liquidity in society to let this running. But that is rather easy because this monetary authority will not set interest rates, but it will look at interest rates. And if it sees that interest rates for certain sectors where there's still capacity to produce go to the roof, it can say we set not a base for the interest rate, but a maximum. That from a certain amount, it says, well, from this amount, we start tendering that there will be made money available for credit opportunities just to have those interest rates reach a certain level and not exceed that level.
So money would come into the economy via government spending still. Is that right? It would still, I'm trying to think how the money gets into the economy. We have a transition and changes to electronic cash. So now my paycheck, if I have a job, comes from my boss, who is now paying in digital cash, but does government still create cash and spend it into the economy to make things work? You know, how does my boss get that money?
The monetary authority has to focus on two things: zero inflation, and make sure that there's at all times adequate liquidity buffers well spread throughout society. And it knows it because it can see the allocation of money. What it also must avoid is hoarding of money, because money is liquidity, it's not a store of value. So if someone amasses too much of liquidity, it will get the message, well, you have to re-spend it, recirculate it, otherwise we'll tax it away. Mm. So I call this monetary taxes.
Mm.
So the monetary authority starts with a certain amount of money, and it has a certain instruments to make sure that it starts, that it goes on and recirculating. If the markets don't do it because there's too much hoarding, it will force recirculation upon it. Then it has to look at interest rates. They must not go through the roof, so it can use interest rates in a in completely different way as it's used now, to lend money into circulation by tendering. But it can also say, well, we need to make, because lending money in circulation is a temporary measure, and it's a market investment oriented measure. But the bulk of new money that must be made into circulation goes via the political process. So then the monetary authority says, well, we need to increase the amount of money in circulation. So we create those monetary objects and we hand them to the political part of the government, and that may decide how it wants to put that in circulation. It might lower taxes, it might spend it or lend it or do whatever it thinks it wise.
But what regarding transparency,
you said
something about...
Howard, yeah. Sorry, I have to interrupt. I want to make sure that others have a chance too, if that's okay. We only have 4 minutes. Sorry, Howard. Stephen, and then Joe, hopefully, if we can get to both of you. Stephen? Are you still there? You're on mute, Stephen.
Sorry. I'll try to be succinct and I'll let Edgar answer, but it's a question for Edgar and everybody. And it comes from a family I met where the head of the family was a gambler. And he asked, and it's sort of like a next generation question, and he has a request. He's wondering, in the future, could we have like a social security money that guarantees, you know, like maybe earned income credit or some basic money, and then we can have money on top of that called wild money, and that would be the money he knows he could gamble with. And so, but how do we make sure that everyone in society is going to have a fair go in life, and we're taking care of our basics? In this country, the United States, we're going backwards right now in this regard. And I'm wondering if you or others, but for you first now, Edgar, if you have any thoughts on any ideas between distinguishing going into the future, social security type of money and wild money.
Yes, I have a specific idea about this. I make the distinction between the digital monetary objects that you have in your safe and the moment that you start using them for consuming, but also for investing or gambling. Now, my idea is that in the first place, we should think, well, let the people decide for themselves. So they are free to do whatever they want to do with their money. But if you see that lots of money, lots of people start investing in a way that's actually gambling and losing it, that would hurt financial stability, because the main indicator for financial instability is that everybody has at all times adequate liquidity buffers. So if they spoil them, then the state might do something with rules to avoid that. And such a rule could be that you are only eligible to invest, so to spend your money not as a consumer, but as an investor or a gambler. You can only do that if you have a certain amount of digital cash in your digital safe, and you cannot use, for instance, the last $50,000 in your digital safe for such purposes. That might be implemented in a digital cash system. And I use this argument specifically when I have discussions with bankers, because they always use the argument, well, people will spend their money anyway, and there will be other more evil financial institutions offering their all kind of baloney financial offerings, and they will lose their money anyway. I say, well, if the people are that dumb, indeed, and it's a problem to our monetary system, to financial stability, well, we can fix that with a very easy rule, very understandable rule.
Thank you.
Oh, okay, Joe.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
So Edgar.
Hi, Joe.
See you.
That I have your Minsky story already implemented in mine.
Hey, you know,
When I listen and I try to comprehend the significance of digital cash, you know, as we're saying, oftentimes I hear you interstate that cash and money, that digital cash and money are the equivalents, okay? And I'm hoping that I'm right about that. And so when I think of all the things that that we have with the NEED Act and the Chicago Plan and that, where we have a monetary authority and the monetary authority determines how much money, mm-hmm. and very similar to what you said about how the monetary authority makes sure that it gets into circulation, you know, through the government, you know, through however the government determines is the right way to do it. Well, that's very similar also, okay? So I really wonder if there's more to this dialogue than the technology, than, you know, the difference between digital and electronic. And what is it about either one of those that either presents itself as a problem or a savior in terms of making what I think that we all see to agree the monetary system that we want to have, which is the one that you have been describing in terms of its virtues. So here's the thing. I don't want to overburden you with an answer so much as to invite you back and to say, you know, I don't think this conversation is not only complete, but I think that we're, you know, kind of trying to turn a big ship around, and some of us want to use tugboats and some of us want to use thrusters, and so we're trying to figure out what's the best way to do it, but we're agreeing, you know, that we want to turn this big ship around, and what's the value, what's the real essential necessity of going to digital cash versus being able to implement the NEED Act? In other words, if either one of those courses were available to us, if either one of those paths were available to us, why would we go with one or the other and not one or the other? That's kind of my big question, Edgar.
Yeah, well, one thing in response is that I'm not talking about technology. I'm talking about the concept of money. I'm talking about debt money and debt-free money. And my claim is that digital money enables us to base the money system on a homogeneous supply of debt-free money, which consists of physical cash and digital cash. And why digital cash? Well, it's convenient and it enables to pay over distance. It's yeah. also so that this development is taking place, and this is the main inroad that we have in politics. No, it's one of the inroads that we have in politics to get a political discussion about this going. Maybe I have to correct myself here, because the main inroad that we have currently in politics, that's not about digitization, but about something else, that we made politicians aware that at this point, the public has no choice, has no option to store its money safely, but to withdraw it from the bank and put it under their mattress. But there is no way to have your money, well, then digitally, in a convenient way, available to you, without lending it out to a bank. And that was a wake-up call for politicians, and that is what drives the debate about money in the Netherlands currently. So that politicians, they unanimously demanded in parliament that there should come something which enables the public to choose to put their money not on a bank, but safely somewhere in a digital safe. So in a nutshell, this is where the political debate has its basis now, and from there we can move on. And the next step in this debate has more to do about distortionary policies in credit than with money, because now we are putting attention on the privileges that banks have in getting cheap funding and being subsidized by the state and a central bank. So there's the credit system is one is a rigged system, and we try to make politicians aware of that there is no free market in credit system, but there is a rigged system in which certain financial institutions use government power to win the competition.
But with regard to that one, okay, you know, again, if I boil it down to the difference, let's say, between the NEED Act and what you're talking about, the NEED Act takes away from the banks the privilege of issuing any circulating meter denominated in the unit of account of the government. And that is really the power that the banks have. And so if it takes that away, then what are the banks, what other privilege do the banks have that are, you know, that they can utilize to, for any type of purposes that's not legitimate? And
yeah, well, what you have to take away, indeed, that is the parity between deposits and the currency. You have to take that away. But you do not take that away by just saying that, but you take that away by taking away the institutional setup that does that.
Yeah.
And an institutional setup that's called, basically, the central bank. You have to take that institution away.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree about that at all, not at all. Well, I hope that, you know, again, I don't want to keep you. I'm hoping that we can further this conversation either along, you know, the coffee house lines, or when you're going to be coming and presenting at the AMI conference. Am I right, Edgar?
No, not this year, because I'm moving to another place. So, and I do that in that time.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't know why I thought that. Well, in that case, then we have to have some more coffee houses on the subject.
Yeah.
Okay.
Resume some more.
So it's around noon. I want to be respectful of your time, Edgar, but in light of the growing interest in this and just how knowledgeable you are, we definitely would like to have you back maybe later this year and further this discussion. So thank you again. Before Edgar goes, can we have just a few appreciations of what he offered of our time together?
Thank you.
Delighted in Onskeld's success.
Yes. Thank you.
Hartelijk bedankt, meneer Wortman.
Yeah, insgelijks.
I think one of the things that took place was we went from the simplicity of money to its sophistication, and we covered, you know, from metalism to digital cash, and thank you for that. Very well done.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else? Appreciation,
Riker? I think what I gather from the conversation is that there are kind of two different levels of monetary reform. It seems like to me what he's talking about is more about how do you free individuals from the banking system so that they can operate without having to have those type of intermediaries with the bank, as opposed to what we're usually talking about is how do we fund different stuff. And so there are two levels of freedom from banking. And I think digital cash offers a different type of look at it to say, I don't have to be involved with the bank at all if I don't want to. So that's what I take from it.
Yeah, well, I recognize that, and I'd like to respond on that, because when we did our campaign for our Well Citizens Initiative, we first thought, well, we have to tell the public, make aware the public, about how much additional government spending power, debt-free spending power, will be unleashed. So we started to focus on that, and we saw that we got no traction whatsoever. We only thought we were idiots, and we were there to screw up the money system. So we just stopped to put that on top of our story, to put that high on the, on our flag. But of course, that's one of the inroads. Of course, that relief, debt deleverage, and additional government spending to address the big issues that we have here on the planet. Indeed, definitely.
I'll just say, just thank you so much. I know that you're very, very busy with many, many obligations, that you made time to do this with us. And also just how very accessible your language is, that you could have somebody like me who has very little monetary experience or just somebody off the street and be able to communicate these very complex ideas in a way that people can really appreciate and understand and get people thinking. So thank you, Edgar.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm happy about that. Yeah.
Edgar.
And I'll be happy to join again. And congratulations with your own organization.
Yes.
IMMR membership.
Yeah. Yes, that was recently approved. Thank you.
Yeah.
Feel free to join.
Yeah. Make sure that NAM America takes the lead.
we'll do our best. Although, everybody, let's take a 5-minute break. People who would like to continue this discussion, because it was a lot here, Edgar will be leaving us, but we, for those of us who want to continue, we can continue the discussion, and let's come back in about 5 minutes then at 12:15. Okay.
Thank you, Bo Young, for setting up the talk.
Thank you to Bo Young and Edgar.
Yeah, okay.
Good day.
Hi, Edgar.
I'm checking out.
Thank you, Edgar.
And everybody else, let's take a short break. We'll see you at 12:15.